روز.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, first day of November, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. warns that the Hamas attack is galvanizing terror groups worldwide.
They are seeking to capitalize on this moment to galvanize supporters and organize for attack.
Britain's King Charles III continues his visit to Kenya today, Wednesday. Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission accuses government forces of extrajudicial killings against civilians. Liberians want invalid votes reduced. And November runoff elections. The African Union calls again for a return to constitutional order in Niger. A Ugandan court orders American couple to compensate a tortured 10-year-old. Uganda reacts to U.S. threat to halt Uganda's participation in the AGOA trade pact.
It doesn't surprise me, and I don't think it surprises any of us, because the Americans are being vindictive against the government of Uganda. They still have a hang-up on the anti-homosexual bill, and they're doing everything possible to punish us.
And animal welfare groups in Namibia decry the consumption of dog meat. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Terror groups around the world and across the ideological spectrum appear to be getting a boost from the Hamas terror attack against Israel that killed 1,400 people, most of them civilians. VOA National Security Correspondent Geoff Selden has more on new warnings from U.S. officials.
U.S. officials say the change in tone following the Hamas terror attack is most striking with terror groups from the Middle East, hit hard by years of U.S. counterterrorism efforts.
They are seeking to capitalize on this moment to galvanize supporters and organize for attack.
National Counterterrorism Center Director Christine Abizaid tells U.S. lawmakers Al-Qaeda and Islamic State are featuring the Hamas terror attack in a new wave of propaganda. The FBI is equally concerned.
We are in a dangerous period.
FBI Director Christopher Wray.
You often hear the expression, if you see something, say something. That's never been more true.
Geoff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
King Charles III said on Tuesday there could be no excuse for British colonial atrocities against Kenyans as he began a four-day visit to Kenya, but did not offer the apology demanded by some in the East African nation. As VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo reports from Nairobi, addressing aspects of Britain's colonial past, issues related to the climate crisis, education, and the importance of national security will top the King's agenda.
The royal visit kicked off with a welcoming ceremony at the State House led by Kenyan President William Ruto and the country's First Lady. It was followed by a visit to Uhuru Gardens National Monument and Museum, a new location dedicated to telling Kenya's history through Kenyan voices, where the king laid a wreath at the tomb of the unknown warrior. Right after, King Charles and Queen Camilla went to the Eastlands local library, where young and old lined up inside to greet the couple. Joel Aluoch grew up in the area and couldn't believe the king was paying a visit to the library he's known for so long.
This is very phenomenal. We are so elated to be in the group or entourage that is going to meet the king, his majesty, the king. It is a lifetime experience. It's so happy that he actually chose to come to Eastlands, where we are born and bred.
VOA also spoke to a few other attendees, including Eva Aholi, Rahma Abdi, and Lucy Vihenda, who were lucky to not only see the royal couple up close and personal, but even shook hands with them.
I feel great. It's a privilege to greet a king and a queen. I feel special.
I feel happy. And I tell them, Jambo, welcome to Kenya.
It is a privilege and honor, first of all, to see the king and the queen and to shake their hand. And we wish them well. Tell them, Karibu sana, Kenya.
The last phrase means a big welcome to Kenya. This is the third foreign trip for the royal couple and their first to Africa since Charles became king last year. Kenya holds a symbolic significance for Charles' family because of what it represented for his late mother, who was in Kenya when she learned her father had died and she had become queen. This trip comes as the African nation celebrates 60 years of independence from Britain. Javas Bigambo is a Kenyan lawyer and a governance specialist. He recalls Kenya's hard-fought struggle against British colonialism.
There was the issue of picking up or taking up the land of the locals when Kenya was a British protectorate from 1901. Through the time of the struggle for independence, the Mau Mau struggle, where a number of Kenyans suffered in the hands of the British.
10 years ago, Britain apologized and agreed to pay compensation to thousands of veterans of the Mau Mau nationalist uprising in Kenya, which was brutally suppressed by the British colonial government in the 1950s. In Kenya, Mau Mau veterans and campaigners welcomed the apology at the time, but said the compensation of about $3,500 per victim was not enough for the pain, suffering, and long-term effects the community endured. VOA reached out to the embassy for comment, but have not heard back. King Charles and Queen Camilla will spend 2 days in Nairobi and then 2 days in the coastal city of Mombasa, where they plan to meet with environmental activists, conservationists, artists, entrepreneurs, veterans, and young people. Mariama Jalu, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stated his intention to halt the participation of Gabon, Niger, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in the African Growth and Opportunity Act, also known as AGOA Trade Program. The announcement on Monday in a letter addressed to the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives comes as the response to what President Biden describes as gross violations of internationally recognized human rights by the Central African Republic and Uganda. Additionally, he cited Niger and Gabon's initially to establish inability to establish or make consistent progress in safeguarding political pluralism and the rule of law. The decision is set to take effect on January 1, 2024, when the designation of these nations as beneficiary sub-Saharan African countries under AGOA will be terminated. Douglas Mpuga reached Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Henry Okello Oyam, for his reaction.
It does not surprise me, and I don't think it surprises any of us, because the government, the Americans are being vindictive against the government of Uganda. They still have a hang-up on the anti-homosexual bill, and they're doing everything possible to punish us for that. Through the World Bank, they have already asked the World Bank to suspend the activities with us. Now they're coming through against us through AGOA. And we're expecting much more to come. Recently, they even issued a warning advisory against American businessmen to come to Uganda. I advise them to come to Uganda. And now is this. So we are sure more are coming, because that's how the United States government behaves. School playground bullies.
But Uganda is not the only country in Africa that has homosexuality as an illegal activity.
That's what I'm saying. They're not being fair and they're not being just. I challenge them to the Middle East countries, which have worse draconian measures against people who are homosexuals. Middle East countries, they're there. Big Middle East countries. But just because of trade opportunities, trade, and because of the green buck, the America is ready to overlook all those that has happened in those countries, as opposed to Uganda, which does not have the kind of financial muscle those Middle East countries have. So it's very unfortunate. That's why I said this is typically of a school playground bully.
Does it surprise you that Uganda is grouped among countries that have had coups like Niger, Gabon, Central African Republic?
It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me at all. If you know that Uganda today, the peace and security, the return of Somalia to be a stable country and formerly a failed state, is because the government of Uganda's armed forces went there when the Americans failed. You remember the Black Hawk down? It's Ugandan troops that went to Somalia, pacified Somalia, and that's why today Somalia is peaceful, because of our troops. We are not being given credit for that. We have over 1.5 million refugees in Uganda, left, right, and center from different countries. We're not being given credit for that. We are helping Americans fight their wars against terrorists around the world. We are there helping them from ensuring that these terrorists do not go to mainland America. We're not being given credit for that. So for us, we were taking on our stride. We are not going to cry tears.
Have you had any engagement with the American government?
Well, we have not, but at appropriate, we will definitely be engaging them, engaging the ambassador, and I'm sure our ambassador in Washington will be talking to the relevant authorities. But I do not think we will much will be made of it, because there are individuals within the State Department who are misleading the Biden administration into taking such measures, because they want to get their way, and they want to get their satisfaction, and they want to get their day with Uganda.
Henry Okello Oyem is Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. He was speaking with my VOA's Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, the first day of November. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. An American couple in Uganda has been convicted of cruel and inhumane treatment of a 10-year-old boy who was in their care. The couple was found guilty of 6 charges and ordered to pay more than $26,000 in compensation to the boy, who is now in a children's home. Halima Atumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
There's an ongoing armed conflict in Amhara region since August this year. And these instances that we cited of heavy artillery shelling, including drone shelling, indiscriminate shelling of residential areas, are just those instances that we've been able to confirm, James. It's not a complete account of all that has happened over the past 3 months, because we haven't been able to go in person and investigate. And this requires serious investigation.
You mentioned house-to-house search. Why are the Ethiopian security forces going house-to-house searching? What are they searching for?
Well, these instances of extrajudicial killings are credible reports we've received from families of victims and eyewitnesses and other sources of information. And these searches usually happen looking for members of the armed group that the government security forces are fighting in the region. The reasons that they give them is you're harboring armed group members, you support the armed group, you give information to the armed group, you have weapons, hand over your weapons. We've heard gunshots in this area, give us the information. These are some of the things that the members of the government security forces that are carrying out these extrajudicial killings are telling the victims.
Now, your commission is sanctioned by the government. I mean, the government knows you exist. Yes. So did you approach the Ethiopian government about this latest report that you have? And what did the government say?
Yes. All our statements and reports go through rigorous information corroboration process. And as part of that, of course, we always ask, we've also indicated in the statement that some of these sources are government sources themselves. Yes, we will continue to follow up with government officials to follow up on some of our recommendations, James.
Really helped me to understand, because we thought the conflict had ended. Mm-hmm. So where did this conflict come from now?
Yes, James, this is another region. This is Amhara, which is still in the northern region. And this is a conflict that has escalated since August 4, James. It's a different region than Tigray, yes. It's in Amhara. It's still in the northern part of Ethiopia.
And how would you describe the fighting there?
Well, it's a full-fledged armed conflict, that's for sure. And there's an armed group on one side, and there's government forces on the other side. All the zones of the region have been affected by conflict, either ongoing still or that has ended. Several areas have been changing hands. They've been controlled for some time by the armed group, and then changing hands back to government security forces. So, yes, it's colossal and it's very concerning, very alarming.
That was Tirikua Getachew, Director of Law and Policy Department at the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, She was speaking with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. We apologize for this report. The African Union has reiterated its unequivocal condemnation of military coups for overthrowing democratically elected presidents on the continent. In its latest communique adopted by the Peace and Security Council at the end of its meeting last week, the AU again called for a return to constitutional order in Niger. The U.S. French 2 Africa Service reporter Abdul Razak in Niamey has details.
Yes, James, through this press release, the African Union Peace and Security Council asked the AU Commission to kindly appoint a high-level representative to support the transition through the organization of a national dialogue for a return to constitutional order and a sustainable peace. The Council, which has obviously acknowledged the current transition, has pleaded for full involvement of Economic Commission of West Africa, ECOWAS, in the process, while asking the sub-regional organization to ensure that the effects of sanctions on Nigerian population are reduced. Furthermore, a field mission will soon be dispatched to Niamey to discuss with the various stakeholders on the agenda of a return to constitutional order, announced the Council, which reiterated at the same time its request for the release of former President Mohamed Bazoum, as well as all political detainees.
VOA's French to Africa reporter Abdul Razak was speaking with us from the Niger capital, Niamey. The National Elections Commission of Liberia and other stakeholders are instituting measures to reduce the high number of invalid votes as the country goes to a November 14 runoff. Denise Nipsey has more from Monrovia.
There were a total of 114,000 invalid votes nationwide during the October 10 first round presidential and legislative elections, according to the National Elections Commission, also known as NEC. For some, the ballots were marked more than once or had other problems. Liberians are concerned about such a high number of invalid votes, especially for a country of about 5.2 million people. They say such a number deprives citizens from exercising their democratic rights. This has led to a cross-section of citizens getting involved with educating everyone about the voting process, because they say the NEC have very little about civic and voter education during the first round. Augustine Tama, the head of the Secretariat of the Liberia Elections Observation Network, Leon, attributes the huge number of invalid votes to the lack of adequate funding.
One of the primary challenges that we see in this election was the way the National Election Commission received funding and how those fundings were apply to civic and voter education. And because the National Election Commission was challenged in terms of the way funds were disposed to the National Election Commission, some of these major activities were not taken care of because the National Election Commission was prioritizing what they thought could be much more needed in order to move the electoral process forward.
Tama says his organization has begun voter education for the runoff through its social media platform and engaged partners to begin rolling out similar plans. Councillor Yvette Chelsin Wure is the coordinator of Women's Situation Room, a group that encourages a peaceful and inclusive election with a focus on women. She says her organization is also reactivating its voter education program.
Again, we are going to start the talking bus later on this week. We are in the 7 counties that the Women's Situation Room is covering. In those counties, we will once again be taking out the talking bus and doing voters education as part of that, because we feel it's essential as we go towards the runoff elections that the voters learn how to vote. We are hoping that stations like our national television station will start showing voters education at least twice or three times a day so that our people have the visual impact, you know, and let us have it translated in our national dialect.
Sam Cole is the Deputy Director of Administration for the Strategic Communication Committee of the National Elections Commission. He explains how the commission will ensure a low number of spoiled votes during the runoff.
The election now is just between two parties, so it's going to be a shorter ballot, one ballot, and the pictures are going to be clearer, and we're going to make sure that people actually know how to mark the ballot when they go to vote. We are also making efforts to produce the what we call Know Your Candidate ballot. Pretty soon we'll be putting our people into the field, including the CVE cells across the 73 electoral districts.
According to NEC, the 114,639 invalid votes during the first round constitute 5.88% of the total number of votes. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipsing in Monrovia, Liberia.
An animal welfare group in Namibia has called out against the theft of dogs in the country that end up on the plates of consumers who regard the domestic animal as a delicacy. Vitalio Anguilla has this story from Windhoek, Namibia.
For many people in Namibia, dog meat is considered a delicacy, especially amongst the Awambo people of the Bantu ethnic group in northern Namibia. Dahafa Erastes lives in the Havana informal settlement in Windhoek. With a population of about 80,000, dog meat sales are brisk. She says the Awambo eat dog meat because it is highly regarded in their culture. She says they don't know about diseases because in their culture, there is a saying that goes, once something is well cooked, it cannot be poisonous. Medical professionals say dog meat can carry cholera, anthrax, even rabies. And animal welfare organizations have long been speaking out against the consumption of dog meat. Bernard Haufiku is a medical doctor in Windhoek.
He was also the former minister of Namibia's Ministry of Health and Social Services.
In some countries, you have as many dogs being slaughtered and as many diseases such as rabies, cholera, and some parasitic diseases that are dangerous to humans that are contracted through this process of slaughtering dogs. It speaks more to hygiene and sanitation than the dog meat itself.
But some locals are fighting back. They say dog meat is an important part of some people's diet. Reports of a missing dog named Dalton reignited the dog meat debate in Namibia this summer. After the Weimar runner disappeared, activists say he was later beaten to death in an open market where his remains were prepared for sale to customers. Critics expressed outrage, starting a petition and holding protests calling for an end to the dog meat trade. Activists say the way dogs are being slaughtered is inhumane. Dogs are bludgeoned to death using the backside of an axe. In Asian countries, they are hanged, they say. Sylvia Breitenstein is the director of operations at the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty Against Animals.
If they are going to slaughter it, I want it slaughtered ethically, humanely. These are terms we use, okay? But like I say, beating something to death is not the way to go. Strangling something to death is not the way to go. This is something we can look at in slaughterhouses for cows.
According to Namibian law, dog meat cannot be sold on the market as food. But animal rights experts say this law is generally not enforced. As for vendors like Erastus and many others who sell dog meat for a living, a plate of dog meat costs less than $1. And they say that's much more affordable than lamb, beef or pork. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
Chad's transitional government has agreed to allow an opposition leader who fled the Central African country to return after a deadly crackdown on protesters demanding a quicker transition to democratic rule. This, according to a statement released Tuesday by the Central African Regional Bloc, the ECCAS. Success Masra fled Chad after dozens were killed and hundreds injured as security forces brutally cracked down on demonstrators in the capital, N'Djamena, on October 20, 2022. The government issued an international arrest warrant against him after he left. But Democratic Republic of Congo's President Felix Tshisekedi, who has been appointed by the ECAS to mediate Chad's return to constitutional rule, signed a statement saying that the transitional government and Nasra had signed an agreement on Tuesday. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com and connect with us on all social media platforms.